So I think we discussed that traumatic brain injury can be quite a potential overwhelming presentation because, of course, these dogs or cats can die if you don't treat them appropriately. But that fortunately, a lot of these patients can be treated in first opinion practice. And during this lecture, we're going to start discussing some pathophysiological concepts. Unfortunately, that's really necessary so that you understand why some types of treatment are indicated and why some other types of treatments are not indicated. So what we're going to discuss today, and I think this is where I lost you the previous time, we're going to start with the pathophysiology, then initial assessment. And what is very important there is to recognize which patients can be treated, and unfortunately, recognize those patients that, despite your best efforts, will not survive treatment, which will be very straightforward and at the end, realistic expectations. And hopefully, at the end, you should answer some questions like, is it true that aggressive fluid therapy is contraindicated in patients with traumatic brain injury? Should you and when should you use mannitol? Should you give steroids? And why do you sometimes have that patient seem fine? And why do they suddenly deteriorate? So I think those are quite clinical relevant questions that I hope you can answer after this lecture. So we start with pathophysiology, and then it's important to understand the concept of a primary and a secondary brain injury. So the primary injury really occurs at the moment of the brain injury. So the dog or the cat smashes his head, there might be a hemorrhage, a laceration. There's nothing you can change there. So that's the primary injury. But this primary injury initiates kind of a cascade of biochemical and molecular changes into the brain, which causes a progressive deterioration in clinical signs. And that should be your target. So that's something that you can try to treat. And it's a little bit illustrated here. So this is the primary injury. There's nothing you can change. But then over time, typically seconds, minutes, but even days, this injury can get more severe. And therefore, these patients can deteriorate over time. So this secondary brain injury is quite complex. And there are multiple factors involved. And the most important factors is energy failure, failure of the sodium-potassium pump, intracellular swelling with cytotoxic edema. Calcium plays a very important role. And then because this calcium then initiates a lot of destructive cellular pathways. And also very important would be formation and release of oxygen species and free radical damage. So typically, all these factors, they interact with each other. It's kind of a circle that keeps itself existing, and that results in continued brain damage, increased intracranial pressure, and eventually death. So, like I said, most of the energy used by the brain is used for one thing only, and that's used to maintain the function of an ATP-dependent sodium-potassium channel, so ATP-dependent, so that's oxidative metabolism. So normally, what the brain does all the time is pumping sodium outside the cell and keeping potassium inside the cell. So if the brain fasts without energy, this pump stops working immediately, and then what you get, because all in the sodium will kind of come inside the cell that brings a lot of water with it. So you get cellular swelling, and that is often referred to as cytotoxic edema. So also that sodium is, of course, charged. So it will change the polarization. So what you will get is a depolarization, and that then triggers a sudden influx of calcium with release of glutamate, which is toxic, and then the increase of glutamate causes again a massive increase in intracellular calcium, and as you can see from the slide here, it's a little bit of a perpetual cycle that keeps itself moving. So, like I said, calcium it's really a very important factor in a lot of destructive pathways, like all the inflammatory pathways, and also the free radical oxygen production. So, free radicals. And oxidative stress is very important in acute brain injury. And why? Because these free radical species preferentially damage cell membranes that contain high levels of polyunsaturated fatty acids and cholesterol. And that's exactly what brain tissue exists of. So brain tissue is rich in membranes with high levels of polyunsaturated fatty acids and cholesterol. So free radical species really play a central role also in acute brain injury. So like how we started, we said normally the brain uses a lot of oxidative metabolism. The brain doesn't have big energy reserves, so immediately the brain has to go to this anaerobic metabolism, which is associated with ischemia because it's with a lot of glycolysis and lactate formation. So again, this ischemia, it contributes to this production of free radical species. It promotes accumulation of lactic acid. And then again, of course, lactic acid promotes further brain damage. So it's very clear to understand from this. And I think that's where I want to go now with this rather complex complex discussion, is that hypotension and hypoxia are super important in traumatic brain injury because they worsen brain ischemia and they promote this secondary brain injury. And as you know, hypotension, hypoxemia are very common in traumatized patients. And hypotension and hypoxia, you will also see later, they will be the primary targets for you. They will be the primary therapeutic targets for the clinician being confronted with traumatic brain injury patients. So something else that you might have heard of are the concepts of intracranial pressure, autoregulation, and compliance. As you know, intracranial pressure is the pressure exerted by the tissues and fluids within the skull. And then there's something else which is called the cerebral perfusion pressure, which is kind of a measure how much blood goes every second towards the brain. And the cerebral perfusion pressure is dependent on two. One is, of course, the intracranial pressure. Like if the pressure in the skull is very high, there will be less blood going. But what is very interesting, it's also dependent on the mean arterial blood pressure. So you see again here, although for me it's not necessary to remember this equation, it's very important to know that, again, your blood pressure is very important here. So if the cerebral perfusion pressure is directly dependent on your mean arterial blood pressure, that could be very bad news, because in theory that could mean that every time you're hypertensive, when, for example, when you're stressed, that all blood will go to your brain and you're at risk of having a hemorrhage, or the opposite, when you're hypotensive, that you will faint all the time. So luckily, the brain has compensation mechanisms for that, and that's called autoregulation. So the autoregulation, that's the intrinsic ability of the brain to maintain this normal cerebral perfusion pressure despite fluctuations in systemic blood pressure and metabolism. So what is very important to know is that normally, under normal physiological circumstances, the brain is able to adapt to changes in blood pressure and oxygenation. These compensation mechanisms don't work in the brain-injured patients. So one is pressure autoregulation. I think it's more for theory. It's when normally if the mean arterial blood pressure rises, you get vasoconstriction in the brain. So there's less blood flow going to the brain. The opposite happens if the mean arterial blood pressure falls. And this mechanism normally works when the blood pressure between 50 and 100 millimeter mercury, then normally you get a normal or a constant blood flow to the brain. Something similar happens with chemical autoregulation. So when there's an elevation in partial pressure of CO2, you get cerebral vasodilation, so you get increased blood flow to the brain. So again, the same, for example, if you're exercising a lot and you're building up a lot of lactate, the brain can compensate for that. So normally what you see here, what's most important are these kind of straight lines here, is that in the normal circumstances, when there is fluctuations in blood pressure or partial CO2 pressures, that the blood flow, the cerebral blood flow, remains constant. But these, I say, in normal physiological circumstances, because these compensation mechanisms don't work as well in the traumatic brain injured patient. And this brings again, very important, is that it's extremely important, and that's your primary target, that the blood pressure and the oxygenation of your patient is the first thing you should consider when you see a traumatic brain injured patient. Something else you might have heard of is intracranial compliance, and that's the ability of the intracranial components in the skull to decrease in volume in attempt to maintain normal intracranial pressure. You might have heard of something like the Monroe-Kelly doctrine, and this really says, and that's really the problem that we have, is that the skull is kind of a closed box. It's incompressible, and in that box are three structures. It's the brain, the cerebrospinal fluid, and blood. And if there's an increase in volume of one, for example, the brain starts swelling, then the animal can compensate by kind of pushing out cerebrospinal fluid or blood out of the skull. So that's again another compensation mechanism, and that's something that we typically see, for example, with animals with chronic brain tumors, that they can compensate very well by pushing out that cerebrospinal fluid and blood. And that's a little bit illustrated in this figure. So this is the brain surrounded by blood and cerebrospinal fluid. But then if the brain starts swelling, you get an outflow of cerebrospinal fluid and blood to compensate for this, because of course the skull itself cannot expand, which is kind of the problem. But it's also true that this compensation mechanism has its limits. So what happens is that during the compensation, the animal will show very little clinical signs. The clinical status of your patient will not really change. But when the limits of that compensation is reached, your patient can deteriorate very, very quickly. And that's typically what we see in a patient like here, a patient that has a brain herniation. So you see here the brain, there's a very big brain tumor in the brain. And you see here that the brain has no space anymore and it tries to escape the skull. And that's something that we called brain herniation. And especially this region of the brain here, the brainstem is very vulnerable because, of course, if everything starts to escape the skull, this brainstem here gets compressed and that's incompatible with life. So that can result in immediate death for these patients. So this is the reason why you sometimes can see that a patient does relatively well, but then suddenly deteriorates and dies in a few minutes. And that's again illustrated here. So this is intracranial pressure and cranial volume. So you see the patient can compensate quite well, only minimal changes in intracranial pressure, but then suddenly it reaches here this level of decreased compliance, and then his clinical status deteriorates rapidly and dramatically. So that's really something to consider, even when you see a dog or a cat with traumatic brain injury with relatively mild clinical signs, that those clinical signs can worsen dramatically in time if you don't recognize this compensation mechanism. So that was a part of pathophysiology. So I think what is very important to remember there is again that oxygenation and hypotension are very, very important. Also that the brain has a lot of compensation mechanisms to compensate for changes in blood pressure, oxygenation, but they don't really work when the brain is injured. And that there's also a compensation mechanism that works for increased intracranial pressure. But when that compensation mechanism is exhausted, clinical signs can deteriorate rapidly. So what is very, very important for you is initial assessment. Like I said, you have to save the dog's or the cat's life, but you also have to prevent or avoid putting in a lot of effort and wasting a lot of money in patients that cannot be saved. So that's second, obtain initial prognosis. And then you will see that treatment is spectacularly unspectacular. You might even be disappointed after this lecture how little we do with or how easy it is to treat animals with brain imaging, with brain trauma. And then the last is the role of imaging. Is imaging necessary? Is referral necessary for a CT scan or an MRI scan? So, what is very important is when you know that an animal comes into your practice with a brain trauma, there's a lot of stress, and you really, really focus on, oh no, it's a brain trauma. Should we do mannitol? Should we do this? Should we do that? But it's definitely possible that the brain trauma is not the animal's most life-threatening condition. So it's like with every emergency, you should follow the ABCs of emergency treatment, and you should treat the most life-threatening condition first. If the animal is already seizing, give immediately antiepileptic drugs. Still do a general physical examination, get some bloods, and place the animal with the head slightly elevated, a little bit in a position like this, because this will really improve the venous return. So the blood will easier go back to the body instead of all the blood pooling in the head. But it should also not be too steep, because if it's steeper than this, then the blood cannot go anymore to the brain. So 30 degrees or something close to 30 degrees is ideal. So what is then very important is I have to obtain an initial prognosis. So a complete neurological examination is often not possible. It's possible that these animals are not responsive, they are not ambulatory, so it's really not that useful to start doing all those spinal reflexes, proprioceptive testing. But what is very important, and it's again something that sometimes goes wrong, is that you have to recognize immediately which patients cannot be saved anymore. And the question comes there, which patients come already into your practice with a herniated brain? Because you sometimes hear this terminology where they say the patient is brain dead, and it means that they will never recover, but their vital functions are still fine. So their heartbeat, their heart rate, their breathing is all completely normal, but they're unfortunately brain, and we're going to discuss now how to recognize these patients. So specific abnormalities are associated with a poor to even grave prognosis, and those are animals that even where I work, we do not recommend further treatment anymore. And that's bilateral mydriasis with a negative papillary light reflex in combination with coma and decerebrate rigidity. And those are two abnormalities that I think you should be able to recognize. And if I see an animal that's in coma in combination with this bilateral mydriasis or decerebrate rigidity, I do not consider further treatment anymore. I go to the clients and say, unfortunately, it's over, and we should put your dog or cat to sleep. Something as a comatose mental status and absent brainstem reflexes. And all of you have probably heard already of the Glasgow Coma Scale. In animals, this is called a modified Glasgow Coma Scale. And this is something that we can use to determine the prognosis further, and especially to monitor your patient after you started treatment. So, as we said, changes in the pupil size can be indicative for increased intracranial pressure. So typically what happens first is that you go from a normal pupil to very meiotic pupil. It can be very small, sometimes even like pinpoint. That occurs relatively early in patients with traumatic brain injury. So that doesn't concern me too much, but it does indicate that we should start treatment immediately. When intracranial pressure gets worse, you will have mydriasis. And when you have coma in combination with bilateral mydriasis that's not responsive to light, unfortunately, that indicates that the brain has herniated and the brainstem is not working anymore. So meiosis progressing to mydriasis is really dramatic. That's really, unfortunately, the end stage of increased intracranial pressure. So again, bilateral mydriasis with negative papillary light reflex, very, very important. It should be in combination with comatose mentation. That should be indicative of irreversible brain damage. Further treatment should unfortunately not be attempted anymore. So this is again illustrate. So this is a normal pupil. They progress to meiosis. Then treatment should really be started immediately and aggressive. And that can progress when really the brain herniates, as you see here. The brainstem gets compressed completely, and then you get mydriasis with negative papillary light reflexes. That should be considered of a grave prognosis, and the animal will not respond anymore. So that's indicated here. So this is a patient with early increased intracranial pressure. And then in the video here, so this is a patient that we assess. So you see It's a bilateral, it's a mitriatic pupil, negative pupillary light reflex. So this would be typically a patient, if I examine him after this, I would go to the OR and unfortunately discuss that we would not recommend further treatment anymore. But what is very, very important, a lot of people know that changes in pupil size can be an indication for increased intracranial pressure. But what a lot of people make a mistake against is this should be in combination with a comatose mental status. We see quite often animals with a traumatic brain injury with quite a normal mental status and midriasis or meiosis, but that doesn't mean anything. That is not a prognostic indicator. So only a comatose mental status in combination with those changes in pupil size can be used as prognostic indicators. So if you see a cat like this, it's obvious the cat has a brain, but the cat is just sitting upright. But you see it has also an ocular injury, and because of that, she has meiosis. This, for me, is not a prognostic indicator because the cat is not in, is not having a comatose mental status. Similar here, this is the cat is bright alert. You see, this has a midriatic pupil. When we shine light, the left one constricts, but the other one, so it's a midriatic pupil with a negative pupillary light reflex. This is not at all a negative prognostic indicator because the cat has a normal mental status. So don't get too carried away with these changes in pupil size. It only means something which is in combination with a comatose mental status. So something else that you should be able to recognize is a very specific posture that we call decerebrate rigidity. Again, this is suggestive for brain herniation and irreversible brain damage. So again, what you should see, very important, a comatose mental status. So that's very, very important. Opisthotonus and extensor rigidity of all limbs. So three factors: opisthotonus, extensor rigidity of all limbs, and very, very important, a comatose mental status. So if you see this, again, unfortunately, whatever you will try, the animal will not recover. So what is, however, very important when you see these cases is that you stay very calm and that you don't confuse this decerebrate rigidity with something else, because a posture that is very similar is decerebellate rigidity. What you might see is that there's flexion of the hips, but that might be difficult to recognize. But very, very important, animals with decerebellate rigidity have a normal mental status. Like you see, this dog is completely aware of what is happening. This decerebellate rigidity has nothing to do with prognosis. It's just an indication that the dog has a cerebellar problem. It's something that we see quite often in animals with a stroke in the cerebellum, something that has a very good prognosis. Another posture that can mimic or that can be difficult to differentiate from this decerebrate rigidity is Schiff-Sherrington, because the animal has extensor rigidity of the thoracic limbs. This is something that typically occurs in animals with a thoracolumbar injury. So they are typically have extensor rigidity in the thoracic limbs. They are paralyzed in the pelvic limbs, but again, they have a completely normal mental status. So it is very important when you see these patients that you stay calm and that you really ask yourself the question, is the posture normal, abnormal, but also is the mentation normal or abnormal? So I mentioned quite often now the value of a comatose mental status, because when we assess mentation in patients, when it's neurologically abnormal, it's typically decreased. And that goes from obtundation to stupor to coma. And what's the definition of coma? It's that the animal has such a decreased mentation that it doesn't even respond anymore to a painful stimulus. And that's illustrating this video. So in the video, I'm pinching the dog's toes. You see, the dog is not responding at all. So this is the definition of a comatose mental status. So Something else that we said is something else that can be used as a prognostic indicator are absent brainstem reflexes. And there are two specific brainstem reflexes that we use. It's the vestibulo-ocular reflex and it's the cornea reflex. So the vestibulo-ocular reflex is that normally you change the dog's position from the left to the right, and normally the pupil should stay centered. It should follow the eyeball. So it's where the animal tries to keep its gaze fixed. So normally when you move the head from side to side, the eyes should move with you and should stay centered. But when we look at the videos, look especially at the right eye. You will see the right eye is not moving. So this dog has a negative vestibular ocular reflex. So again, this would be a negative prognostic indicator. Like I said, the other one that we typically use would be the palpebral and the cornea reflex. So with the palpebral reflex, we tick the sides of the eye. With the cornea reflex, we really touch the cornea, and normally that's very sensitive, and there should be immediately like a retraction of the eyeball or closure of the eye. But then when we see in this dog, see nothing is happening. So see this dog is like non-responsive at all. Then when we do the cornea reflex, see the dog is not retracting his eyeball or anything. And you might also have noticed if I play the video again, that the dog has madriatic pupils, is comatose, it has negative palpebral and cornea reflexes. So again, even if this would be extremely motivated clients without any financial concerns, we would tell them unfortunately nothing will help the dog anymore. And I think that is very important because I get a lot of advice calls where vets ask me, oh, can I discuss this case with you? But then when they discuss the case with me, it's very clear from the conversation that the dog has some of these indications of irreversible brain damage. And then it would be a shame that we give the owners hope, that we keep spending their money, and that we keep spending resources on these animals, because I think it's very important to tell the owners immediately if it's likely that the animal will improve, yes or no. So something that you might also have heard is the Modified Glasgow Coma Scale, and this is something that evaluates three categories. What first is the motor activity. Second is the brainstem reflexes, like I discussed, typically the vestibulo-ocular reflex and the cornea reflex. And then the level of consciousness, like I said, it goes typically from normal to obtundent to stupor. Stupor means they are not responsive anymore to auditory stimuli, but still to painful stimuli. And then coma, where they do not even respond anymore to painful stimuli. Each of these three categories gets a score from 1 to 6. So you come to a score from 3 to 18, where 3 is dramatic and 18 is completely normal. So this has been associated with survival in the first 48 hours after trauma. I find it a little bit unhelpful to really ha use it to help me to determine the prognosis when the patient comes in. So I more use it to reassess patients over time. So, for example, I do the Modified Glasgow Coma Score with one of the nurses. And then, when there are changes in the Modified Glasgow Coma Score, it can be used to start more aggressive treatment. So, this is the paper that suggests that the Modified Glasgow Coma Score can be used to treat or to assess the prognosis and guide treatment in animals with head trauma. And this is the modified Glasgow Coma Scale, where indeed you see is the motor activity, the brainstem reflexes, and the level of consciousness. So then you see again that it's here in three categories, where animals can be categorized in having a good, guarded, or grave prognosis. So like I said, I find it quite challenging to use this to use it to make a diagnosis immediately during the emergency, but I use it quite often to follow up these patients and to identify a change in the neurological status that would that would guide us to start more aggressive treatment. So now we come to treatment, and we discussed in the beginning, treatment is spectacularly not spectacular because it's very well summarized in this paper here. It's from In Practice, and typically we follow a three tiers. So in all patients, we start the first tier, and in most patients, this will be enough. Only if they do not respond, we go to the second tier, and only if they do not respond, we can consider the third tier. But I have to say that tier number three is often quite experimental and very invasive treatment. So typically, you follow step one. If they do not respond, only if they do not respond, you follow step two. So what is step one? We discussed already in the pathophysiology that very important factors in the pathophysiology is hypoxia and ischemia and hypotension. Also because the brain compensation mechanisms don't work anymore. So your primary target of therapy is fluid and oxygen therapy. And in the older days, maybe even till 10 years ago, it was considered that when you would see a patient with acute brain trauma, that you should not give them too much fluids because too much fluids would contribute to brain swelling, contribute to brain edema. Now, it's not only considered not true, it's really considered detrimental if you don't give if you don't give aggressive or appropriate fluid therapy to patients with brain trauma. So, fluid therapy is the first thing you do in these patients. So, your primary target for therapy is restoring normal volemia in those patients. Like I said, aggressive fluid therapy is often necessary. So, what we typically use in the protocol is when a patient comes in, we typically give them a combination of crystalloids and hypertonic or colloid fluids. So, what we typically use where I work is that we give them a combination of crystalloids, often even like a shock bolus, and in combination with a hypertonic saline. And what we do is 3 to 5 milliliter per kilogram over 5 to 10 minutes as a bolus. That gives rapid restoration of blood volume. What is very, very important is that you give this in combination with crystalloids, because if you don't give crystalloids, this hypertonic saline will cause dehydration, and as we discussed, dehydration can cause hypotension, and hypotension is one of the worst things you can induce in a patient with traumatic brain injury. And again, because you use hypotonic saline in combination with your crystalloids, you don't have to give as much fluid therapy. So oxygen therapy is also indicated in every patient with brain trauma. So even if your brain injured patient has normal oxygenation, like when you can evaluate saturation, even when there are no indications of decrease of respiratory distress, if his mucous membranes have a normal color, oxygen therapy is always indicated in patients with brain trauma, because when we discussed with this, when we're discussing the artery regulation mechanisms, the vasculature of the brain will respond to oxygen therapy. So when you give oxygen therapy, there will be decreased partial pressures of CO2. That will cause cerebral vasoconstriction. Therefore, you get a decrease in cerebral blood flow, and therefore you get a decrease in intracranial pressure. In the old days, again, maybe 10, 20 years ago, they considered for treatments of acute brain traumas, mechanical hyperventilation. But if you really take this into the extreme, you of course get extreme cerebral vasoconstriction, and there will be no blood flow going anymore to the brain. So you should not do mechanical hyperventilation. That's completely not indicated in these patients anymore. So like we said, if you reduce this reduction in cerebral blood flow to excessive, you get vasoconstriction and ischemia. So you should avoid hyperventilation. So what we typically do is just flow by oxygen, like you see here in the pictures, just like in this patient, and in this patient here. So typically step one of patients with brain trauma is just fluids. And the fluids is a combination of crystalloids and hypertonic saline and oxygen therapy. And quite often, that does the trick. So this is a patient with a brain trauma, as you see here in this video. So he comes in and you see he has some partial seizures. His head is completely swollen. And the first thing we do is just give oxygen. So this is very unspectacular. Everybody can give a little bit of oxygen. So we don't place nasal tubes or intratracheal tubes, just flow by oxygen to create some cerebrovascular vasoconstriction. And like we discussed in the beginning, if your patient has seizures, they should be stopped immediately. So you see the patient, like in the picture in the middle, we are injecting some diazepam, typically 0.5 to 1 mg per kg IV, and hopefully that just stops the seizures. So the only thing we did in this patient was give fluid therapy and oxygen, and this is then the dog the next morning. You see he's bright, alert, definitely much better than the day before. Also, the swelling has gone a little bit. So even when these patients are referred to us, like a tertiary referral, we have very committed clients, we don't do anything more. And in the majority of patients with traumatic brain injury, this is a treatment, and it stops here. So as you can see, everybody is quite happy here. Of course, it is possible that your patient does not respond to this. So then you go to the next step, and that's diuretics. And this next step is typically still in the first hour. So the traumatic brain injury patient comes to you. You give fluids and you give oxygen. And if it does not show improvement in the next 30, 40 minutes, you go to the next step is diuretics. And this is where you give mannitol. So it is very important. Mannitol is not the first type of treatment that you give to patients with brain trauma. So often what you have in practice is you get a phone call, a dog is coming with a traumatic brain injury, and immediately discussions start. Oh, we should get a mannitol ready, or we should give mannitol as soon as possible. No, mannitol is not your first line drug, because what is very important, it's a diuretic. So if you give mannitol to a patient that doesn't have good hydration, again, you will cause dehydration, you will cause hypovolemia, you will cause hypoxia, and you will even make the traumatic brain injury more severe. And you will make it more severe, you will decrease the chance of survival for your patient when you give mannitol as a first line treatment. So mannitol also has so mannitol typically it can dramatically decrease intracranial pressure. And as some, like for example, when I do brain surgery and I see the brain is swelling and we give mannitol, you just see the brain shrinking in front of your eyes. But it's very important that the animal should be well hydrated. So you should first follow step two. Other mechanisms of action is that mannitol can reduce the blood viscosity. So it increases cerebral blood flow and cerebral oxygenation. So how we give it, typically 0.5 to 2 gram per kilogram as the bolus over 15 to 30 minutes. I think what is most often used is 1 gram. What is very important is that the dose of mannitol is not expressed in milligram. So when I say here gram, that's not a typo. So often it's quite a large volume you have to give. What is also important is that repeated boluses can cause diuresis, and then again, this reduced plasma volume, dehydration, hypotension, ischemia, and then you contribute to an increase in cranial pressure. So typically, we do not give more than 3 boluses over 24 hours. Also, there are some, again, maybe 10 years ago, that people would say, oh, you can't give mannitol if there is a risk of intracranial hemorrhage. You know, theoretically, every patient that you see with traumatic brain injury, there's a potential hemorrhage, but there's definitely no evidence at all that mannitol is contraindicated in these patients. So mannitol can also be given even if you think that your patient has an intracranial hemorrhage. If you don't have mannitol, you can consider another bolus of hypertonic saline. And there are even papers and discussions going on that maybe hypertonic saline is even superior of a mannitol to give in these patients. This is typically treatment of traumatic brain injury. We give tier one fluids and oxygen. If the animal does not respond immediately, like say in the first 20, 30 minutes, and they are normotensive, they are hydrated, then we go to step two, and that would be diuretics such as mannitol. And normally that's what we do. Because I discussed there is a tier three, but this tier three is quite radical therapy. And also, only in these patients, we would consider advanced diagnostics. And also, these are typically patients where we would or could consider surgery. And of course, there are some more controversial treatment modalities such as hypothermia, progesterone therapy, hyperventilation, and doing a decompressive craniotomy just to take off, like skull, so the brain has room to expand. This is definitely not types of treatment that we perform at Rolf Etney College. So we typically follow tier one, tier two, and if, for example, there is a bone fragment that needs to be removed, that's something that we do. So typically, when we do tier one and tier two, and they do not really improve, we do further diagnostics. But I have to say, I think if I see 100 patients with traumatic brain injury, we will only do further diagnostics in maybe 3 to 5 of these patients because, of course, sedation and general anesthesia is not really good in these patients because it's always associated with some hypotension. What is very important on radiographs, you can see a skull fracture, but most skull fractures don't need surgical intervention. So radiographs really do not provide you additional information that would change your treatment. So radiographs of the skull are absolutely not indicated in these patients because most skull fractures do not need surgery at all. Most skull fractures are not associated with specifics in prognosis anyway. If we do further diagnostics, we almost always do a CT scan instead of an MRI scan. And the reason for this is that what we want to see on a CT on imaging is a skull fracture, and if the skull fracture is depressed, and hemorrhages and skull fractures can be better visualized on the CT scan compared to the MRI scan. So, other advantages of a CT scan is it's much quicker, especially if you have, like at the Rolf Etney College, we have a very advanced CT scanner. It only takes a few seconds, probably 10 seconds, to scan an animal from the nose till the tail. It's superior to image bone. So for skull fractures, as you can see here, this is typically a depressed skull fractures. Hemorrhage is immediately visible, while it's not necessarily immediately visible on an MRI scanner. It can be performed under sedation. Animals also can move a little bit. You can, when we say multi-trauma imaging, because what we typically also can see when we do a CT scan is image the chest, the abdomen, all the bones to evaluate for orthopedic injuries. So, and also minimal patient manipulation. On a CT scan, after the scan is finished, you can reconstruct images in all different planes. So you don't waste a lot of time by trying to position your patient completely straight. So that's why in emergency settings, we much more do CT scans instead of MRI scanners. And this is what I mean. It's not necessary for the patient to be positioned perfectly straight because here you see a little bit how after we obtain the initial images, we can create images in different planes. Again, what I said, it can be used to image multiple body systems. Like I said, this if you have an advanced CT scanner, a study like this only takes a few seconds, definitely less than a minute, and we can evaluate here from the tip of his nose till the tail, and here we see also that the dog has a tail fracture. So tier three, like I said, these are typically patients that need surgery, and although that's a very big step, if a patient needs surgery and they are selected appropriately, still these dogs can have a very good outcome. So this is again a dog here with a depressed skull fracture. This is a the fragment, and here it's removed. You see here the brain with some hemorrhage and some swelling, but also this dog made a completely complete recovery. So even if advanced treatment is necessary, if you have to go to this tier three, it can still result in a positive and a good outcome. So what is still very important in these patients, consider comorbidities. So don't focus only on the brain trauma. Maybe that's necessary to save the dog's or the cat's life. But if you go back to this cat, so you see the cat was bright alert. It had definitely an eye problem. That was unfortunately, cat needed an enucleation. But what probably needed more attention was the cat here also has a brachial plexus injury. So it was paralyzed in this left thoracic limb. And it would be really, I think the owner would really not appreciate that they take the cat home, and only at home they realize that the cat cannot move its left thoracic limb and that you don't know why. So luckily for this cat, that could be treated conservatively, and she made a full recovery, but she only needed, unfortunately, an enucleation of the left eye. So it is also important, appropriate supportive care. So these patients, they cannot walk. They have a decreased mentation, so they should be kept clean. They should be turned regularly. Definitely, the eyes should be lubricated regularly. We lubricate the eyes at least every 4 hours. Sometimes, if we have a like a brachycephalic, like a French bulldog or Pekingese, we lubricate the eyes every 2 hours. Physiotherapy can be considered after a few days. When they have seizures, they should be treated aggressively. What is a little bit debatable and controversial, should you start antiepileptic treatment even if they don't have seizures, yes or no? Opinions differ a little bit because we see that up to 10% of dogs will develop seizures later in life as post-traumatic seizures. And of course, also when an animal has a traumatic brain injury and then starts seizuring, that will of course not help the neurological condition. Appropriate nutrition. What is very, very important is the most common complication in animals with traumatic brain injuries is aspiration pneumonia. When we have these animals, we are really obsessed by feeding them, that we only feed them when we feel that that their mentation is good enough. And also then we hand feed them and see if they can swallow properly. So that's very, very important to monitor. Also, when you have to take blood, don't obstruct the jugular vein. If they can't move, bladder management is very important. You have to you have to empty the bladder often for them, and antibiotics. So if they come in, we don't give prophylactic antibiotics, only if they have contaminated wounds or it's necessary for something else. Something that is often forgotten is analgesia. You can really imagine if a dog or a cat is hit by a car against the head, that it will be painful. Which type of analgesia? It's again a little bit debatable. We often use partial mu agonists like buprenorphine, because the danger is a little bit if you give methadone or morphine, the animal will start panting, hyperventilating, and because of the hyperventilation, it can get again changes into their oxygenation status. But it's definitely possible that's more academic instead of a clinical argument. But we typically give in most patients a combination of NSAIDs if it's like a partial mu agonist, like buprenorphine. So I did not mention anything about steroids. So it is again something that historically has been used immediately. Like a patient came in and you said, oh, we have to give a very high dose of steroids to decrease the edema. Because historically, it was considered that if you give very high doses of certain type of steroids, 30 mg per kick, that would act then as a free radical scavenger and therefore kind of help in reducing that secondary brain injury. But this protocol has been extensively evaluated in human medicine. There's absolutely no benefit in giving steroids in these patients. It's actually the opposite. Patients that receive steroids, and in human medicine, there are really beautiful randomized blinded studies. They show that it doesn't have any benefits, and these patients are have an increased risk of life-threatening complications. So this is definitely something that we never give. So when these patients come to us, we don't even consider giving steroids on these patients. So, like I said, anti-epileptic drugs, if they come and they have seizures, we treat them aggressively with diazepam, 0.5 to 1 mg per kick. Hopefully, that will stop the seizure. A drug that we use very often in emergencies is levetiracetam. Some of you might know this as Keppra. And this drug is very popular among neurologists because it works immediately, like in the first hour. It has very little side effects. We will not see this sedation, this ataxia, this PUPD, all these consequences. Also, when you don't want to give the drug anymore, you can just stop it from one day to the other day. It's not necessary to wean it off. So levetiracetam is very, very useful for emergencies. And of course, the drug that we use most often is phenobarbital. One of the problems with phenobarbital in these patients is a very, very common side effect that we see in almost every patient that we put on this medication is sedation and ataxia. So starting phenobarbital might influence your neurological assessment because they might appear more obtunded than they actually are, and that might complicate your neurological assessment. So levetiracetam, like I said, it's very useful antiepileptic drug for emergency situations, and we use this most commonly for cluster seizures, status epilepticus, like all these emergencies. It has effective serum concentrations in 1 hour. It also might have some additional neuroprotective effects. It's very safe. You don't have all the side effects. It's also not necessary to evaluate serum concentrations, so it's much easier. But then the question that we often get is, if you are so happy and such a fan of levetiracetam, why don't you always use it in all your patients with epilepsy? And the reason is because levetiracetam is not useful as a maintenance drug or an add-on drug. And the reason for this is that after 3 to 4 months or 4 to 6 months, most patients become resistant to levetiracetam. So these are some papers about levetiracetam if you're interested. Also, this Journal of Internal Medicine, it's open access. You can get these papers for free. It's a paper that it shows that levetiracetam is very useful in emergency settings to treat status epilepticus and clusters. But this is also a very important paper from a group in Copenhagen, which has a very, very big international reputation on epilepsy research, because this paper indeed compares phenobarbital with levetiracetam as a normal maintenance drug, and it concludes that levetiracetam cannot be used, it's not effective as a maintenance drug, because like I said, initially it works very well, seizures are very well controlled, but then after 4 to 6 months, they go back to their previous level because the animals become resistant, and this is often also referred to as the honeymoon effect, where they go back to the normal level. So, because the outcome is very important, because unlike people, dogs and cats, they can have very, very good recoveries despite substantial loss of their brain parenchyma. What we normally see if they survive the first 48 to 72 hours, that they have a really realistic chance for good outcome, good functional recovery, and a good quality of life. But what is very, very important, and this is something I sometimes see that goes wrong, is that they should be given the opportunity. Because also when a person, for example, when a person is hit by a car against his head, you don't expect them to be back to normal in a few days. And what I often see In practice, is a situation where a patient with a traumatic brain injury comes into practice, there's a lot of stress, then it's very good that first you recognize if treatment should be started, yes or no. Second, that you start appropriate treatment. Third, that you keep them alive for 48 hours. But then the patient is not really improving that much the next days. And then you start losing your confidence. You don't know anymore if this is normal. You start doubting yourself. And then you start discussing, and especially your colleagues, they start saying, oh no, it's really sad. It's really poor quality of life. It's not ethical to keep the animal alive like this. This is really not true. What we typically see, if they are alive, that every day we should see a small improvement. It goes really step by step, baby steps. And it would really be a shame that if you do everything correctly, you recognize that they have a good chance, you kept them alive for 2, 3 days, that then after 4 or 5 days, you start doubting yourself because the animal is not back to normal. People also don't go back to normal with severe brain traumas after a few days. So, that's very, very important to illustrate this. I have a video, and that's the last, so hopefully we'll not have any more technical difficulties. So this is a cat that came in, and as you see, this cat looks horrible. It's not really responsive. It has again an like an ocular abnormality. Also, what you see are very non-spectacular treatment oxygen and fluids. So we're doing like the normal treatment, tier one. We assess if the cat has any indications of a bad prognosis. Now my colleague will test pain perception. So to see if the cat is in comatose, to see the difference between coma and stupor. A little bit, and especially now when she does it again, there's definitely some reaction of the cat. So when we assess this cat, for us, although this really looks bad when you see it, you're like, good, the cat is not in coma, so that could indicate that we can continue. In the next video, so now we're going to assess palpebral reflex, and again they're intact. Again, very good. So now we start our tier one treatment. We assess the cat does not have a comatose mental status, so the papillary light reflexes is not that important. The cat has intact brainstem reflexes. The cat also does not have a decerebrate rigidity. So this will be a cat where we say, oh, despite how she looks, we think she has a really good chance of surviving. So we start treatment. This is a cat 2 days later. And the reason I show these videos, because this is a realistic expectation. The cat definitely looks better, but the cat looks far from normal at this point. But this is an expected normal outcome. And then again, the cat another 6 days later. So when we realized that the cat will make a good recovery, then we made a decision that we could enucleate the affected eye. She also has a feeding tube. But again, we see 6 days later, the cat is again better, not normal. But again, if you would have a person with such a severe brain trauma, it would be already a miracle that only a week later that person would walk around like that. So this is very normal, and this is a positive outcome, and we expect that this cat will improve every day a little bit, and probably in a few weeks will be back to normal. And this is what I typically see that happens in practice, is the cat co an animal comes into your practice. Everybody is very excited. Everybody is really unsure, not really confident because it's a neurological emergency. Some of your colleagues will say, oh, the cat needs to be put to sleep, but you continue. And of course, the next day, the cat is not that much better. Not even, and then your colleagues will say, you see, this is not alive for a cat. This is not good quality of life, but this is completely normal. It will go every day a little bit. And this cat is expected to make a full a full functional recovery. So, my apologies again for the technical difficulties. Hopefully, it didn't affect you too much. I think we're only now 20 minutes over time. So, I don't know if you have any questions.
Hi, Stephen. There aren't any questions in yet. Obviously, if anyone does have any questions, they can email me and maybe I can forward them on to you if that's okay.
That's perfect. Yes.
Okay, great. But on behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Stephen for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.